in less time than it would have taken her to explain the route. They were somewhere north of the city center, racing up a long, looping street and then pulling up with a chirp in the driveway of a big, rambling white house. There was another car parked next to where they stopped, a sleek black convertible, much more obviously sporty than the Jag, as Cora now couldn't help but mentally tag it. It had a red stripe on the hood and a matching leather interior, which gave Cora a nostalgic smile.
Wow. Flashbacks to the Future Industries summer lineup, back around 210, she remarked, pausing to check the nameplate.
Corvette Stingray didn't mean anything to her, but she filed it away as another piece of information gathered about the big universe anyway, as she ran around the Jag and followed Griffin up the walk to the front door. They entered the house to find a very beautiful, very pregnant redhead in the front room, putting on shoes. She looked up at their entrance and blinked in faint surprise.
"I told you, Kate's with Marty and Aiko," she told Griffin. "Why aren't you on your way to Tomodachi? I've got everything under control here."
Then, straightening up, she picked up a small white duffel bag marked with the 3WA logo from the floor by the couch. "Got my ready bag and everything." She noticed Cora then, standing a trifle hesitantly in the doorway behind Griffin, and, slightly to her surprise under the circumstances, gave her a welcoming grin.
"Oh, hi," she said. "Kay Morgan. I don't think I've seen you before. Are you Ben's new AA?"
No, said Cora, slightly nonplussed by her cheerful welcome.
"My name's Cora. I'm, consulting with Chief Hushins on a matter..."
Kay laughed merrily and smacked Griffin's arm.
"You didn't waste any time," she said.
No, she's serious," he replied, rubbing the arm. "She's looking into one of the side effects of the Ragnarok, and we've only just met, so behave," he added mildly. Cora, who was fairly sure at this point that she was sporting the kind of flaming blush that was obvious even through her dark skin, stammered out some sort of denial as well, but Kay was already past that point.
"Well, by a strange coincidence, you are currently beholding another side effect of the Ragnarok," the redhead said with a wicked grin, "and I am off to Boyce Memorial to get it seen to."
She turned to Griffin, pointing at him, and said, "And you are more urgently required on Tomodachi, stud, so don't waste any time standing here wittering about me. It ain't my first rodeo, as you well know, and it is Scald's."
"But what if," Griffin began.
"Oh, I'm hours behind her," Kay said dismissively, shrugging the bag onto her shoulder. "So I don't imagine I'm going to get much action going until sometime tonight or tomorrow morning. And I'm going to a proper hospital anyway, because not locked into weird Viking ideas about having to do this stuff at home," she added with a cheery smirk.
"So go. Jeez, I'm fine. Professionals are involved."
She leaned and kissed him.
"I'll keep you posted. We won't let you miss the show."
Then, leaving him standing there at a loss, Kay turned back to Cora and gave her a less manic smile.
"Nice meeting you. I'm sorry we don't have more time. And I'm sorry about before. The hormones are making me a little wacky right now. Didn't mean to accuse you of anything you weren't actually up to."
Then she grinned again and clapped Cora on the shoulder, adding with a wink of one brown eye, "Although if you change your mind, he gives good consult. See you later."
"At least let me drive you," Griffin protested,
but Kay waved him off with a cheerful hand and breezed out, banging the door behind her. A moment later, while Cora watched through the front room's window, that black car she'd noticed when they arrived darted past with a roar of high-performance engine and a screech of tires on tarmac, Kay grinning fiercely at the wheel. Griffin stood where she'd left him for a moment, one finger still raised as if to interject to the closed door. Then he sighed, turned a slightly weary grin to Cora, and said,
"So that was Kay?"
What was she talking about?" Cora wondered. "Not the first part, I got that," she added with a mildly renewed blush. "The other thing, what's on Tomodachi?" Our friend Skuld lives there, Griffin explained as he led the way back outside. She is also having a baby today. Cora gave him a puzzled look. Your wife just sent you off to tend to another woman in labor first. Yes, Griffin replied, nodding. He wasn't heading back to the car, but rather across the street. Not judging here, but that's a bit weird, said Cora. Griffin chuckled. Tell me about it, he said. None the wiser, Cora dropped that for the moment and asked, Where are we going? The neighbors, Griffin replied. I'm just going to check in on my daughter before we leave. The neighbors, a very tall man and his rather short, red-headed wife, were all in a congratulatory flutter when they arrived. They were plainly old friends of the chief and his wife. Griffin introduced them as Martin and Aiko Rose, told them more or less who Cora was, but didn't get any further than that before a pretty little girl of perhaps two rounded the end of the couch and glomped onto his leg. With a smile, he gently extricated himself and hunkered down to be at eye level with her. Your mother's fine, he said, speaking not as a person stereotypically would to a toddler, but instead as if he were addressing a miniature peer. She's going to the hospital now, and pretty soon you'll have a new brother. What about Skuld? The girl asked, her voice a little thin, but perfectly clear. Griffin smiled. Well, she's not going to a hospital, but she's also fine. I'm going over to see her now. Can I come? She wondered. Best if you stay here for now, he said. Things are going to be pretty crazy for a while. But if you're good for Marty and Aiko, then probably tonight or tomorrow, once things have settled down some. She thought this over gravely for a moment, then nodded. Okay, she said, and hugged him. While doing so, she spotted Cora standing by the door, a little smile on her face. Who's that? She asked Griffin. That's Cora, said Griffin. She's a new friend I've just made at work. Would you like to meet her? The girl gave that question all due consideration as well, then nodded, though she didn't look too convinced, and repeated, Okay. Without breaking off the embrace, Griffin straightened up, lifting the little girl along with him. With a comically exaggerated groan, he remarked, Boy, are you getting heavy. Am not, she insisted. Smiling, he turned and said, Cora, I'd like you to meet my daughter, Caitlin. Kate, this is Cora. Hello, Caitlin, said Cora with a bright smile. Caitlin regarded Cora for a moment, her large brown eyes, very like her mother's, Cora noticed. Thoughtful and just a little trepid. Then, very slowly, she said, Hello, Cora. Griffin had to admire the way Cora kept any reaction other than pleasant welcome off her face as she made the Water Tribe salute and said, I'm very pleased to meet you.
You,
said Caitlin, turning away to bury her face in her father's shoulder.
Hey, it's okay, Griffin said soothingly, stroking her hair. You did very well. You can try again later, okay?
The little girl leaned back to look at him miserably for a second, then lay her head back down again with a frustrated sigh.
Okay. Here, I'll take her, said Aiko, smiling. I think it's time for a nap anyway.
Griffin and Cora parted from the roses and went back across to the Jag, climbing in without discussion. Not until they were on their way back downtown did he remark, I think you're the first person outside our inner family circle I've introduced to Kate, who didn't ask me what was wrong with her as soon as we were out of earshot. Thank you. Cora looked surprised. "I didn't think anything was wrong with her," she said. "She just has trouble talking to strangers. Nothing wrong with that." Seeing that he looked troubled, she reached across the front seat and touched his arm. "She's a beautiful little girl," she said, then added with a slightly sentimental smile. "And she clearly loves her dad. She sounded fine when she was talking to you." Griffin smiled. "Thanks," he said again. After a few seconds of silent travel, Cora said, "So, the lady we're going to see on Tomodachi, you said she's also having a baby. Today." Griffin nodded. "Apparently so." He chuckled. "She and Kay have been coordinating this joint offensive for months, so it shouldn't really surprise me." Cora thought about the matter for a moment, then decided she might as well be blunt. He seemed to like that. "Okay. This is none of my business, and feel free to tell me so, but where's her baby's father? Shouldn't he be on hand for this?" Griffin nodded, evidently in complete agreement. "Yes, he should," he said decisively. "And he will be, just as soon as he can get there." Cora waited for him to elaborate on that. After a few seconds, he glanced across at her, a faint smile returning to his face, and added, "From New Avalon." Another few seconds' puzzlement, and then the fen dropped. "Oh," she said, her face going red. "Man, galactics are weird," she thought. Griffin let the matter sit while he navigated his way back off the expressway, then said, "Would you like the short version, or are you more comfortable just thinking we're weird?" Cora coughed. "Busted," she admitted with a sheepish smile. "How up are you on your Norse mythology?" Griffin asked. "Not at all," Cora replied. "Okay. Remember what I said earlier about the end of the world?" She nodded. He drove the Jag back into the IPO parking deck, put it in exactly the same spot it had been in before, which, even in her current state of bemusement, Cora couldn't help but be pleased by, and climbed out. As they walked back toward the elevator, he said, "The Norse pantheon has three goddesses in it, the Norns, who personify aspects of time. Urter, the past, Vertandi, the present, and Skuld, the future. Skuld and I are old friends. She's how I ended up involved in the whole business in the first place." Said Cora, to show that she was listening. They entered the elevator. She was faintly surprised to see that he didn't press any of the buttons. Instead, he raised his right hand, around which some kind of holographic interface flickered into existence, surrounding his hand and forearm in orange light. He did something to this. The elevator control panel chimed, and then the elevator started going down. "Omnitool," he explained. "Wonderful invention. Gift from another friend. Anyway, Skuld, goddess of technology and the future, on the evening before the prophesied end of the world. Think about that for a second. I gather you have some experience of what we might call the cosmic. Try to imagine what that was like for her." He turned to her, his blue eyes intent on hers, totally serious now. "Imagine being the living embodiment of tomorrow, and knowing that there aren't going to be any more. That every sign you've ever been trained to interpret says the next sunrise is going to be the last one. Not just for you, for everyone, everywhere, ever." Cora got a brief, faraway look that seemed to add a level of experience to her that Griffin hadn't seen before. Without having changed physically at all, she suddenly seemed much older. Not only older than her visible years, but somehow older than he was. "Yes. Yes, I think I can imagine that," she said quietly, gazing solemnly back at him. Tears were actually gathering in his eyes now.
His voice was hushed and a little hoarse as he went on. She was someplace out beyond despair, standing on an icy cliff, screaming at a cold gray sea. His voice caught briefly in his throat, raging against the dying of the light. Cora felt herself tearing up along with him as he wiped at his eyes, then continued, "Kay sent me to her. I did what I could." Then, with a deep breath, he shook himself and seemed to pull himself out of the memory. His tone was more matter-of-fact as he concluded, "Next day, we won the War of the Gods. Barely. And now it's 9 months later, and..." He spread his hands. "Here we are." Cora kept her eyes on his, her own tears not quite shed, as she weighed his words with a grim expression. Then, in a low voice, she said, "You know, I've been around longer than you probably think, and I've seen a lot of strange things. If I was anybody else from Dicho, I wouldn't believe a word of that. But I was in the spirit world that day." As she said it, the impressions of that day rushed through her, swift and distinct, like a fever chill. A sudden hot wind bending the spirit grass, carrying upon it a smell of burning. Naga and her pack howling disconsolately at a sky gone an utter starless black, their voices barely audible over a terrible, thunderous roar that seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere at all. She closed her eyes, spilling the tears at last down her cheeks, and shook her head. "If you had heard that roaring sound, you'd believe that was the world nearly ending." Under normal circumstances, Cora wouldn't have said she knew this man nearly well enough to hug him yet. But these were not normal circumstances, and after telling and hearing that story, she figured they both needed one. Besides, she remarked wryly to herself as she seized him, she'd always been impulsive. He seemed startled for a moment, but only a moment. Then he returned the embrace. His arms were surprisingly strong, but also gentle. And for a moment she was reminded of older times. Then the moment passed, and they were standing side by side again, facing the doors, and it occurred to Cora for the first time that they had been going down for an awfully long time. "Thank you," said Griffin quietly, rubbing his hands down his face. "Don't mention it," Cora said mock casually, the warm little smile she gave him putting the lie to the words. A few seconds later, she went on, "So, I'm not the galaxy's greatest cosmographer by any stretch, but isn't Tomodachi a really long way from here? Also, why are we going down?" "Yes, and it's all relative," said Griffin. Before she could ask what he meant by that, the elevator arrived at its destination with a ding, and the door opened onto a place that was entirely unlike the unfinished chaos of the building above. They were in a matrix of brightly lit corridors, clad in some sleek, silvery metal, high-tech doors here and there, like the Starliner interiors Cora had seen pictures of when researching ways of getting to New Avalon. There were people down here, too, the first ones she'd seen associated with the IPO building apart from Griffin himself. Men, women, and otherwise in blue coveralls, some with ball caps, some with lab coats, going here and there on inscrutable errands. Their faces were almost universally sober but not somber, the expressions of people engaged in serious business but enjoying it. Something in their brisk, upbeat purposefulness reminded her of the glory days at Ursa, bringing a little smile to her lips. Some of the blue suitors touched the bills of their caps to the chief in passing, but there was no saluting or rushing about just because he had come among them, which Cora added to the list of things she rather liked about his style. He led the way down the hallway and through one of the doors,
into a room filled with consoles and unfathomably techy equipment. A small crew of IPO personnel of the kind with lab coats on over their coveralls were at work in here, apparently studying or servicing the object which stood on a dais in the center of the room. This was a massive metal ring, perhaps 20 feet in diameter, its surface covered with curious, almost runic-looking markings. A very pale, dark-haired, bearded man, wearing regular clothes under his lab coat instead of a uniform, looked up from one of the consoles and smiled. "What is that?" said Cora. "Never saw a Stargate before?" Griffin inquired, not sounding all that surprised. "Then I bet you never traveled by one."
No. Traveled?"
He grinned. "You're in for a treat. Andrew," he called to the bearded man, "fire her up." 3 minutes later, Cora stood on an entirely different planet, wisps of sublimating ice vapor rising from her clothing and hair, looking back at an identical metal ring as it spun slowly down to a halt. Griffin turned to take in her reaction, something he always enjoyed with first-timers, and blinked in surprise as he saw that her eyes were glowing, all detail blotted out by white light. "Okay, that was freaky," she said, and her voice sounded like many voices, as a crowd all speaking roughly in unison. She blinked rapidly, shaking her head, and the glow faded away, returning her eyes to normal. "Wah," she said, her voice singular again. "That wasn't supposed to happen." Then, brushing it off, she turned to him, eyes wide, and said, "You just bent space and time. How did you do that?"
"Well, I didn't do it. The gate did," Griffin replied, gesturing to the ring. "It's a machine."
He shrugged, squiring her off the Stargate platform and across the very similar machinery room in which it stood. "I have no idea how it works. Andrew wrote out the main equation for me once." He grinned. "It took 2 hours, 6 pieces of chalk, and the entire length of the sidewalk on the 500 to 800 blocks of Allard Avenue." "Hmm," she mused as they went out into the hall. "I'd like to get a look at that later." "That was months ago. I doubt it's still there," Griffin deadpanned, then smiled at her vaguely grumpy, you-know-what-I-meant look and said, "But he has written a book about it, which I'm sure he'd be overjoyed to sell one copy of."
"I hope so," Cora said. "I could save days and who knows how many yuan if I could veil-bend like that."
Upstairs, the Nakomikoka office of the IPO was a little further along than the main headquarters in New Avalon. Most of the walls were up, if not quite finished yet, and the lobby was staffed. One of the receptionists tossed Griffin a set of car keys without even being asked as the chief crossed the room. Outside, the city was very different, not as vertical as New Avalon, but a bit more sprawling, the streets a more orderly grid. The car Griffin and Cora got into was tiny, so small their shoulders were rubbing together in the middle as Griffin steered, and the driver's position was on the right because people here drove on the left side of the street. They drove to a quiet, leafy borough that was not quite far enough from downtown to be called a suburb, past what was plainly a university campus, up a hill, and onto the grounds of what looked for all the world, to Cora at least, like a Fire Nation temple complex. Here they gratefully abandoned the car, and Griffin led the way to the front door of the main building, rapping briskly on the door. A moment later, the door opened, and a slim, youthful-looking man greeted them, smiling broadly at the sight of Griffin.
"Ben, welcome," he said, ushering them inside. "You're in plenty of time."
"Oh, hello," he said, noticing Cora. "I'm Keiichi Morisato, Skuld's brother-in-law."
Cora introduced herself, as herself, not her Zipangi alias, with a bowing Water Tribe salute.
"Welcome," said Keiichi, bowing.
Are you with the IPO?
No, I'm just a...
She paused, not because what she had been about to say wasn't true, but because she was mildly surprised at this early hour that it was.
Friend, she finished, giving Griffin a wry little grin Keiichi entirely didn't know how to read. He didn't seem to mind, though, declaring cheerfully that any friend of Griffin's, etc., then led them through a foyer of sorts into the house. In the living room, a tall, dark-skinned, white-haired woman in elaborate tiger-striped trimmed clothes lay stretched out full length on a sofa, a decanter of sake standing on the floor by her dangling right hand. She looked up as they entered, recognized Griffin, and grinned a little blurrily.
"And here he is at last, the man of the hour," she said, her voice only slightly slurred. "Hurry, hurry! The prophesied one impends."
Then, noticing Cora, she squinted at her for a moment with cat-green eyes, sizing her up, then gave the blurry grin again, raised her sake jar in salute, and said,
"Hey there."
"Hello," said Cora, slightly at a loss.
"You're a good-looking gal," said the woman cheerfully.
She took a drink, eyed Cora more judiciously, then said,
"The tight top, baggy pants thing is a little weird, but you've got the front and back porches to make it work for you. I like it. Your health," she concluded, toasting her again.
"Erd behave," said Keiichi, in a tone that suggested he'd said it millions of times before, and didn't really expect it to have any more effect this time than on any of the others.
"Yeah, yeah," said Erd. "Hey, good luck in there. Let me know how it goes."
"Well," said Griffin as Keiichi led them down the hall, "I haven't seen her that far gone in a while." Keiichi chuckled.
"She started when Skuld reported that she'd started," he said. "Hasn't slowed down since."
He paused then and knocked on the frame of one of the house's many sliding doors. At a quiet acknowledgement from within, he opened it far enough to put in his head and said,
"Ben's here, and he's brought a friend."
"Excellent," the woman's voice, which had acknowledged his knock, said, and Keiichi opened the door the rest of the way. The room beyond looked to be a small bedroom, sans bed, decorated like the rest of the house in the Japanese style. It was neat and orderly, except for the stack of empty ice cream cartons in the back corner, and even those were arranged very tidily, for all that they seemed intrinsically out of place. In the middle of the room were two young women. One, with long black hair, half sat, half lay on the floor with her back and shoulders propped up on a large cushion. The other, whose golden brown hair was even longer, sat Cezanne next to her, holding her hand. Both looked up as Griffin entered and smiled.
"You're right on time," said the one in Cezanne.
Cora guessed, based on subtle cues like her position and her obvious pregnancy, that the woman lying on the floor had to be Skuld, which would make the speaker Vertandi. A guess that was confirmed a moment later as Griffin introduced them, though after he spoke the latter's name in a formal Norse way, she smiled and said,
"We mustn't stand on ceremony at a time like this, must we? In Midgard I generally go by Beldandi."
Then, rising to her feet, she smiled brightly, her whole face lighting up with a sort of beatific delight, and bowed, adding, "But please, call me Bel, Avatar Korra." Korra blinked. She hadn't said thing one to anybody here about being the Avatar, and indeed would not have expected any of them other than Griffin to have any idea what she was talking about if she had. Then, looking more closely, she realized that there was much more to this lovely young woman than was apparent at first glance, which made sense if she and her sisters were indeed goddesses embodying primal aspects of the universe. Cora wasn't sure she believed that was precisely the case, but she knew spiritual power when she saw it, and this was a spirit entity to be reckoned with. She made her most respectful bow and said,
"I'd be honored."
How we doing? Griffin asked Skuld as he took Belle's place at her side.
Oh, you know, the usual, Skuld replied. Except every 8 or 10 minutes I have a tendency to sort of try and stop time. It's not deliberate, but I can't seem to not do it.
Now that you're here, Belle put in, I'll be able to concentrate mainly on countering that.
I'm a licensed midwife back home, Cora said. I'm sure my credentials are no good here, but I can still help if you want me to.
Skuld grinned. Hey, any pretty stranger Ben likes well enough to bring along on a day like this gets my vote, she said with a wink. Pull up a... Ooh. As she said the last, a drawn-out, breathy moan, the oblong mark on her forehead glowed, the way Korra had heard that airbender avatars' tattoos did when they entered the avatar state. Something in the air of the room seemed to ripple, tickling the higher centers of her consciousness, and she felt her own eyes flicker in sympathy, like they had when she'd come out of the Stargate. Something felt odd about it, though. The experience was faint, attenuated, like an echo down a pipe or a bad telephone connection. Belle closed her eyes and concentrated, the narrow diamond tattoo on her own forehead lighting up in response, and that weird, twisty feeling abated, stabilizing until the contraction ended and Skuld relaxed, her brand going out. "Pfft," said Skuld, puffing her cheeks. "Sorry. If you think that felt weird out there, try it from in here," she added with a wry grin. Cora nodded to her with a similar little smile of her own, then said, "You said those are less than 10 minutes apart now? Has your water broken?"
"Yep," Skuld confirmed.
"Okay." Cora considered the room for a moment. Wish we had time to set up a tub, but... Oh well, not the time to go changing everything up anyway. Not a problem. I'm going to need a few gallons of clean water, though. Doesn't have to be hot, just clean."
"I'm on that," said Keiichi.
"If you've got it, bring a big cup of crushed ice while you're at it, please," Cora called to him as he left the room at a trot.
"Crushed ice, check," Keiichi's reply came back up the hall.
"Griff, you stay right there," Cora directed. "Once the ice gets here, your job will be to supply it as needed. She won't be able to drink once things really get moving." Then, hands on hips, she looked around again, as if taking stock of her surroundings. On this sweep, she noticed the table standing to one side. At first, she thought its gleaming, polished surface was glass, but now, looking more closely, she realized it was ice, a big slab of it, set into a handsomely worked metal surround that was intricately carved with winged serpentine creatures. Sitting atop this, slightly sunken into a depression in the surface of the ice so that it couldn't roll away, was a spherical white object about a foot in diameter.
"What's this?" she wondered, stepping over to inspect it more closely.
"That," said Griffin without batting an eye, "is a dragon's egg." Cora blinked, but the question she asked next was not, "Are you crazy?" It was, "Why is it sitting on ice?"
"It's a white dragon's egg," Skuld said. "They won't hatch if they're too warm."
"Oh," said Cora. "Okay, fair enough. Is it hatching today?"
Skuld nodded. "Ought to pop within an hour or so of me," she said wryly.
Cora mused. "Been a long time since I was at a dragon hatching." Then, turning a grin to Griffin, she said, "This is turning out to be a more interesting day than I was expecting."
"We aim to please," he replied with a smile.
Cora chuckled, then seemed to settle into herself, folding her hands before her chest in a meditative gesture and closing her eyes. For a moment she didn't speak, didn't move, just arranged herself into a state of perfectly composed concentration. Then, opening her eyes again, she smiled.
Okay, she repeated. Where can I wash my hands? Several eventful hours later, all was quiet at the Morisato homestead once more. The afternoon was turning toward evening as Cora and Griffin stood by Skold's bed, enjoying a cool, celebratory beverage while mother, child, and Dragonette slept, all cuddled together into a single, achingly homey bundle. Corwin Virgil Ravenhair and his boon companion, Nall Silverclaw. Cora wasn't entirely sold on the boy's middle name, but it was apparently to honor an old friend of his mother's, and the Avatar was not going to argue with a thing like that, even if she had been inclined to be so gauche as to criticize a parent's naming choices out loud in the first place. After fondly contemplating the sleeping baby boy's face for a few moments, some distant, muffled past-life voice, maybe Yangshan's, was of the opinion that he was going to be a very handsome lad when he grew up. Cora slugged back the last of her lychee juice and nudged Griffin with an elbow. "Hey," she said quietly. "I don't mean to trample your moment here, but shouldn't you check in with Kay?" "I have," Griffin replied. At her quizzical look, he showed her the face of the wrist computer he was wearing. There was a round red gem set into its metal casing, like the face on a wristwatch. As he turned this toward her and she looked into its softly shifting scarlet glow, it gently touched her consciousness to impart a simple, wordless message. The knowledge, if she hadn't had it already, that this was Benjamin Hutchins, Griffin of the IPO. Said Cora, struck momentarily speechless. "Oh. You're right, though. We should get moving soon," Griffin murmured, lowering his wrist. "Just, you know, in a minute." Cora smiled. "Yeah," she agreed, putting a friendly hand on his arm. "In a minute." As they were leaving the house, they saw that Erd had either fallen asleep or finally reached her limit and passed out on the living room sofa. Someone, probably Keiichi, had covered her with a blanket. Keiichi and Beldandy saw them off in the foyer. Cora was surprised to see that Bel, too, had a baby, a little black-haired boy not too dissimilar from Skuld's newborn son, in her arms. "Our firstborn, Hiroshi," she explained to Korra's questioning look. "Another of the Ragnarok's happy aftermaths. He was born last week." Cora gave her a thoughtful look, then said carefully, "You recover very quickly." "There are a few advantages to being a goddess," Bel said merrily, and Cora, laughing, had to allow that she had a point. Then, becoming serious, Bel said to her, "Thank you for your help today, Cora. I feel as though great friendships have been forged. Perhaps, in a couple of cases, literally lifelong ones." Cora smiled. "I hope so," she said. Then she bowed, fist in hand, to both of them, and said formally, "Thank you for welcoming me into your home, Professor Morisato, Lady Vertandi." "It was our honor, Avatar Cora," said Keiichi with a deep bow. Then he grinned and added in a more natural tone, "Safe travels back to New Avalon, you two. Hopefully we'll be seeing you again soon." "Both of you," Bel put in. "What nice folks," Cora mused as Griffin drove the tiny IPO pool car away from the temple. "Bel and Keiichi?" Griffin asked. "Yeah, they're the best. You weren't really catching Erd at her finest today, but between Hiroshi last week and Corwin today, she never really had a chance. She's scared to death of childbirth." He grinned wryly and added, "As am I, actually, so the prospect that I've still got one to attend today..." Cora laughed and patted his knee. "You'll do fine," she said. "You handled the first one like a champ."
For the first one, I didn't have a choice, said Griffin with a laugh. Due to an astonishing failure of foreplanning, for which her mother and I have to split the blame, Caitlin was born aboard ship in hyperspace. Kay and I were the only ones there. That was a trip. I didn't have time to freak out until it was all over, and by then I was too tired. Something to be said for that, Cora agreed, recalling the birth of another lifelong, so far, friend. The Stargate jump back to New Avalon was less jarring, now that she knew what to expect. It was a bit weird to emerge from headquarters back onto Allard Avenue, transported all but instantly back where they'd started from, and doubly so because the time in Nokomikoka was different. There were still a couple of hours of daylight left in New Avalon now. While they walked the 3 blocks to Philip Boyce Memorial Medical Center, Cora asked, "So, that psychic jewel there?" "The lens," said Griffin. "It's a means of identification, a communications device, and a psionic shield, among other things. Skuld's invention. We use them to identify and protect the IPO's best people, including our top-level field agents, the experts of justice." "Nice title," said Cora. "Kate came up with it," said Griffin with a fond smile. As they walked, Griffin explained the basic remit of the IPO and the Lensman, quoting the remark from Autobot leader Optimus Prime that had become the Lensman program's motto. "Gather our galaxy's best and our brightest, and stand them up in line against the darkness." "The Lensmen are our best and brightest, and the experts of justice are the best of the best. People who have not only the strength of will and moral character to be Lensmen, but also the personal power and skill to face the greatest threats to freedom and peace the forces of darkness have to offer." He gave her a speculative look, then added, "People like you." Cora looked skeptical. "Me? Come on." With a self-deprecating chuckle, she went on, "After today, I'm fully prepared to believe that you and I are fated to be insta-BFFs for some reason. But it's a long jump from there to the galaxy's best and brightest." "Well, we can find out," Griffin said. "There's a test. Complicated bit of sorcery, really, but she makes it look easy. Skuld does to determine if a likely candidate has what it takes to be a Lensman. We call it the test of light. When she's back on her feet, and you saw Belle, that's not going to take long, she'd like to test you." "How do you know that? She never mentioned it." Griffin smiled. "Not out loud, but she has one too," he said, holding up his lens again. "Well, I don't know," Cora said. "I have a lot of responsibilities back home. I intend to keep in much better contact with the big universe now that I have some friends out here," she added, grinning and bumping his shoulder with hers. "But I'm probably not going to be able to come outside all that often, or stay for terribly long. However tempting the idea is, I can't join a space police force on top of everything else I have to do." "That's not a problem," Griffin replied. "Lensmen and IPO members aren't completely overlapping sets. The program for selecting and equipping Lensmen has only been operational for 9 months, since Skuld unveiled the idea in the aftermath of the Ragnarok, but there are already a handful who aren't formally IPO officers. We call those Grey Lensmen," he went on. "You might think of them as experts without portfolio. People we count among the galaxy's best and brightest, and know we can rely on in an emergency, but who, for whatever reason, can't or don't want to join the day-to-day of the organization itself." "Well, I'll think about it," said Cora. "Meantime, this is your stop," she added, nodding toward the front entrance of the hospital. Griffin regarded the building's frontage for a moment, then nodded. "Yep." Then he turned and said with a smile, "I am reliably informed that I have time to get a quick bite to eat, and it's just occurred to me that those sausage rolls were a long time ago.
You like noodles?
Cora grinned. That's a safe assumption.
The noodles in question turned out to be in the hospital lobby itself, served by a small Japanese restaurant tucked away between the gift shop and the main reception desk. It was fairly busy at this hour, with its clientele balanced between about half civilians and half people in scrubs. Cora staked out a corner table while Griffin got them each a styrofoam box of yakisoba and a bottle of water.
Hey, Zipangi style, said Cora cheerfully as he put hers down in front of her. She snapped apart her chopsticks, dug in, chewed her first mouthful thoughtfully, and swallowed.
Not bad, she pronounced. It's no Naruks, but it'll do.
Griffin smiled. Sometimes I get lunch here even when I don't have business in the hospital, he said. There used to be another one in the entire state building, but they closed when the marché opened.
They talked about favorite eateries and their hometowns in general while they scarfed down their noodles, both having realized all at once how hungry they were. It wasn't deep conversation, nor even particularly consequential, just cheerful mealtime chatter, but it was free and comfortable. She told him the details of her first afternoon in Puckett's Landing, then compared it, with hilarious wryness, to a similar day back in Republic City, which had ended in a somewhat less congenial meeting with the local constabulary. He, in turn, almost caused her to laugh a noodle out of her nose with an anecdote about an undercover expedition to Earth he and some other WDF founders had taken once, at a time when they were all outlaws on that world. At meal's end, they tidied up their table and left it to a pair of hungry-looking interns, then sauntered out into the brightly lit hospital lobby, still giggling about the latter story's punchline.
So Zoner says, "It depends. How much of a hurry are you in to get to Lhasa?"
When their course brought them even with the revolving doors, Cora said,
"Well, Griff, I have to say, you know how to show a girl a good time."
"Weird," she qualified, "but good. I've had actual dates that weren't this much fun." She frowned thoughtfully, then said, "Actually, bad comparison. I've had actual dates that were complete frickin' disasters. Anyway," she grinned brightly, "good luck with your evening's program, and all my best to Mrs. Griff."
"Aren't you coming up?" Griffin asked, sounding mildly surprised.
"We won't put you to work, but I'm sure Kay would like to see you again."
With a little smirk, Cora tapped him in the middle of his forehead with the first two fingers of her right hand. "Remember, I am a total stranger to everyone you're taking me around to see today. Hell, I'm practically a total stranger to you." Griffin smiled at her, entirely without irony, and said in a perfectly sincere tone of voice, "I feel like we've been friends for years." Cora blinked at him, momentarily thinking he was either having her on or hitting on her, then blinked again as she realized that she agreed with him.
"I wonder if I knew you in a past life," she mused, then shook her head.
"Sorry, I know that probably sounds seriously dopey and new agey from your perspective, but it's a real thing where I come from."
"No, I'm not unfamiliar with the concept," he said.
"It could be. I'm reasonably sure I've never been to your home world. I'd remember a phenomenon like that. But you never know." He shrugged. "I'm not inclined to argue with it or dissect it. I just feel it, and I've learned over the years to trust my instincts."
"Hmm," said Cora, nodding thoughtfully. She looked off into the middle distance for a moment, like she had in the elevator, seeming momentarily much older. Then she returned, shook her head again, and smiled.
"Anyway, you've got an appointment, and I've got to take care of some other stuff, but I'm not leaving town right away. You'll be hearing from me again soon." Then, not because it was of the moment, like the first time, but because it just felt right, she hugged him again. "Thanks for taking me along today," she said.
It was really...
She groped for a word. Special. Thanks for coming. Griffin released her and stepped back a pace with a slightly bewildered smile. Around them, medical personnel and visitors passed here and there, paying their display no attention at all. It was Boyce Memorial. They were used to people getting sentimental in the lobby. This would have been a great day anyway, Griffin continued. But you've made it greater. Cora grinned again. It has been pretty great, she agreed, then thumped him on the shoulder and promised, I'll be in touch, before stepping into the revolving door and letting it sweep her out to the street. He stood and watched her go until she vanished out of sight beyond the lobby's glass frontage, then turned and headed for the elevator. Excerpt from Avatar Korra's Field Report to the White Lotus Advisory Council. Date, Cinti Air, Liu UA 25, 272 ASC. Section, Persons of Interest. Hutchins, Benjamin, a.k.a. Griffin, Chief, International Police Organization. Born June, Liu UA, 20th, 1973. Yes, you read that right, 146 years before Sozin's comet. More on this in a bit. On Earth. Human, but, like most of the founders of the Wedge Defense Force, genetically modified in a way I don't even vaguely understand. And I don't feel bad about that. Not many people out here understand it either, to judge from the press reports I've seen. Such that he's basically immortal. Looks like he's about 30. This guy's CV reads like mine, Aang's, Roku's, and Kyoshi's all run together if we had been operating on a galactic scale. Seriously, it'll make your head spin. He's been almost everywhere and done all sorts of crazy things. He might know pieces of more martial arts than I do, though he hasn't bothered mastering most of them. Too busy being a fighter pilot, starship captain, and wandering troubleshooter, founding major cities, organizing galactic protection forces, and so forth. The really startling thing about him is how normal he is, considering all of the above. He has moments where how old he is and how much he's seen slip out around the edges, but for the most part, spending time with him is like hanging with a regular guy. He lives in a normal, if big, house in a decent neighborhood with his wife, a fellow 400-year-old galactic badass, and their, as of about 20 minutes ago, two children. We hit it off almost immediately, which you'll see in the section about what I spent the day doing. You'll also see there that his domestic situation is a bit odder than I implied above, but, well, you'll see. In fact, we hit it off so well I could swear I knew him already. The obvious way for that to have happened is if the Avatar spirit met him in a previous life, mine or his. But as far as he knows, strangely enough, in the light of the above, he hasn't been to Zipang or Dicho before. I'd ask the others, but I'm a long way from the spirit world out here, and so far I haven't had any luck making contact. I know you're smirking at me, Jinora. We'll see how funny you think it is when it happens to you. Anyway, might just be one of those things. Either way, it's a good thing, since it seems likely that if we are going to have closer contact with the galaxy beyond Zipang, Griffin and his agency are going to be our interface. The next phase of the operation will consist mainly of following up on this possibility. It's too early to say for certain, but my gut tells me I've found the right man at last. Not in that way. Stop laughing, Jinora. Stay tuned. Cora. Airy Productions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios presented Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, The Legacy of Korra, Book 6, Galaxy, Chapter 1, An Avatar in New Avalon. Book 6 will continue with Chapter 2, The Great Ziggurat Zeppelin Raid of 2391.